top Fox News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I'm so glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show coming your way on a very, very busy Tuesday. This hour, you're going to hear from Dennis Prager, one of the most inspirational stories in Hall of Famer radio guy with a deep thinker, religious bent, moral bent, too. He's going to be with us, too, with his brand new book. But first things first, we're looking at week two of a war that's 47 years in the making. No question about it. In my mind, this is worth fighting. The pressure right now on the president, forget politics. It's on the oil prices. So the Strait of Hormuz has to be open to drop the oil prices. It's not that we are running out of oil. It's the projection that if this is shut down and the storage capacity on Saudi Arabia and Qatar with natural gas and others, that will run awry. So if I'm an investor in commodities or oil, then they say, okay, it's time to raise those prices because it's more of a risk. Understood. So let's escort the ships in. You have Macron saying we're sending 11 ships to the region. Let them escort. G7 got together and said, let's not tap into our strategic oil reserves. That includes us, even though Chuck Schumer wants to do it. So the president's got these military objectives. He's doing it. He stared even people in his own cabinet down and said, I got to do this operation. So, Mr. President, open up the strait or do this. Now, you might not know about this, and I think you should. It's called Karg Island. It's one island. Now, they say Venezuela is Venezuela. It is not like Iran. Karg Island is oil island. 90% of the oil coming out of Iran goes through Karg Island. It's undefended. Grab it. Grab the island. Hold it. So if you want to pressure a regime, you can bomb it. We're doing that. You can target, kill. We're doing that. Wiped out between 40 and 80 of their leaders, understood. But if you really want to deny a regime that's flat on its back anyway, they can't even get water and basic needs to its people before the war, why not grab this island? Now, what is this island? Who's thought about it? Jimmy Carter thought about grabbing the island in 1979 when they grabbed our hostages. But again, he said, I think it's too bold, too direct, and he decided not to do it. He says, starving the regime of oil reserves. The plan was ruled out. It was too confrontational. That's exactly why President Trump became president, because he will confront in our best interests and he will not do half measures. Tell me, you're not going to believe this. The year was 1988. The newspaper was The Guardian. Donald Trump, in doing publicity for The Art of the Deal, says, I would be harsh on Iran. They've been beating us psychologically, making us look like a bunch of fools. One bullet shot at one of our men or ships, and I would do a number on the Karg Island. I'd go in and take it. Mr. President, you were way ahead of your time. People underestimated how much you knew about the region, obviously. You understood the history with Iran, clearly. And Karg Island is even more valuable today. Do what you did with Venezuela and Maduro. You sent your armada over there. You stopped ships from coming in and coming out. And then you took these ships, these old, and you sent them to our country. You hold on to Karg Island. They'll have zero money coming in. China gets none of that oil and gas. That will get their attention while you escort. You drop that oil down to $65. You drop that down to $65 where it was before. The pressure lessens on our economy. And again, we look at our overall security. We stop having to keep military assets in an area because we've defanged the evil Ayatollah, killed him, and I hope eventually kill his son. Here is Dan Brulette. He was on Kudlow. He's the former energy secretary. He talked about this. Cut 7.
Look, I think what we're seeing in the marketplace today is exactly what we expected a week ago. I may have been a little bit off with regard to $100 oil, but you know what? That it moved up to, what, 119, I think, early this morning. 120 is back down in the 90s right now. Mm. It goes to show you that this has much more to do with psychology and with pricing risk, which many people get wrong, than it does with the actual production or the physical supply of oil. And we saw that very clearly today in the marketplace.
Yeah, then that's if you can get that down. So it went up to 120 when the president had a speech just before the close of the markets. And he said, hey, I'm not going to last much longer. We're only going to do this 5 or 6 weeks and we're way ahead of schedule. Then the whole world said, OK, maybe we can charge a little bit less per barrel. And it dropped under to about 90. Look, when Russia invaded Ukraine, oil went up to 120 and they called it the Putin price hike. Remember? So that's why they had to tap the oil reserves, because he would not do any drilling. That's why we do the Venezuelan deal with the devil, with Maduro, that kept him alive, sustained him in exchange for promising free and fair elections, which he didn't do. And he should have left power, and he never did. That's Joe Biden's world. That's not this world. That's why I think we have to act. By the way, we're achieving our military goals. We have not shaken the institutions yet inside Iran. But they have really decreased their number of drones and missile strikes. On Monday, they had only 18 drones into the UAE, down from 136 on Sunday. 45 total into the Gulf states, missiles, all of the states together, and about 100 drones. That's important. So we're seeing right now the besieged military, that Gestapo dressed in plain clothes that buzzes up and down with motorcycles. They are still seen throughout these cities, making sure the people don't rise up who sadly are unarmed and can't really defend themselves. So I saw the Grand Ayatollah being the Ayatollah's son being replaced now as the supreme leader. And then you see the people come out to celebrate him being named. They don't even know this guy. They say that in Iran, he's basically just a name, and that he is looked at as a relative of the Ayatollah. That's it. Okay. But they just have a new supreme leader. Who is this guy? Really rich. What has he done? He bought worldwide real estate. He owns a building across the street from the Israeli embassy. Why do you think that is? I think it's time to grab it. President can't come out and say, hey, we got to eliminate this guy. But you know he wants to eliminate this guy. So I can't go out and say that. You know, he's going to die. But my hope is he's going to die. Word is they killed his mother. They killed his father, obviously. They killed his sister. They killed his wife. And he's gotten so wounded, he might have lost a leg. Here's Marco Rubio on what sacrifice we have made, losing seven already, which is one is too many. But this is extremely low considering the danger in this mission and how ruthless our opponent is. Cut forward.
The United States is currently engaged in an operation targeting one of the world's leading hostage taker, the world's leading sponsor of terrorism, the regime in Iran. And first, I think we would all take a moment both to offer our thoughts, our prayers, and our condolences, and to honor the families of those who have fallen, the seven Americans who have lost their lives in the initial hours of this operation, incredibly brave Americans, and you saw six of them dignified return over the weekend.
Look, President always said in Iraq, take their oil until we're paid back. Go to Karg Island, take the oil until we're paid back for inconvenience. Here's this word from Petrus Katrinius. He's the research fellow in climate, energy, and defense in Europe and the Office of Royal United Services Institute. So I want to give you an international flavor. He says seizing the island would cut off Iran's oil lifeline, which is crucial for the regime. Of course, with shipping via the strait now stopped, they cannot sell the oil anyway. But looking ahead, seizure would give the U.S. leverage during negotiations, no matter which regime is in power after the military operation ends. Get the oil, use the oil, get it to people that need it. To me, it's the type of thing that Trump should be doing. I also think he's moving on the uranium. That would be another huge victory. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show on an extremely important Tuesday. When we come back, an interview with Dennis Prager. He's one of the deepest thinkers, smartest people you ever talked to. He's also deal with personal strife. That story when we come back on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
This is Ainsley Earhart. Thank you for joining me for the 52-episode podcast series, The Life of Jesus.
A listening experience that will provide hope, comfort, and understanding of the greatest story ever told. Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
So Dennis Prager needs no introduction to anyone who has a radio or television. And you see he's multifaceted throughout his entire career, always making an impact, as with his next book. And the name of the book for that Dennis has out now is called If There Is No God, The Battle Over Who Defines Good and Evil. And of course, this is a case that there is a God. He's a multi-bestselling author. He's also the founder of Prager University. One by one, little by little, he's educating a whole generation, or has been, in the right way of American history, especially. Dennis Prager, congratulations on the book. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be back, Brian.
Always thinking big picture, but can I keep you small picture for a second? The President Trump has done something that six previous presidents didn't want to do. or chose not to do, maybe wanted to, and that is take on Iran, who I think is the personification of evil. It is a risky mission, of course, but is the mission worth it in your mind?
It is worth it, and I think of his bombing of the nuclear facilities about 6 months ago.
Yep.
That was an incredibly risky endeavor, and I'm not sure any other president would have done it, Republican or Democrat. And one of his arch foes, Tucker Carlson, actually said, and it's amazing that he's not held accountable for this, he said that this would lead to World War III.
Yep.
Well, of course, it didn't lead to World War III or any war. Our pilots came back, thank God, perfectly healthy. So I trust this man. But aside from trusting this man, if it works, if somehow the greatest sponsor of terrorism on planet Earth is reduced in its capacity, or even hopefully eliminated, it would be a tremendous boost to peace on Earth.
Yeah, I mean, he's well underway to doing that. Certainly, his political risk and the Grand Ayatollah. Basically, not only does he act evil, he dressed the part in all black. So I appreciate that. So it wouldn't be confusing to anyone at home. So we're going to see. I just am shocked that people are pretending as if Democrats are pretending as if this is a sudden problem that Donald Trump decided to create on his own, when they know it's bedeviled six other presidents, Democrats and Republicans, to this day. And I was just speaking to a CIA officer who said, when he was trying to settle things down with the insurgency in Iraq, we kept telling leadership, we can't make any progress if we don't take care of Iran. They're the ones causing all this unrest. And we never did.
That's exactly right. This, if there is such a thing as evil, which goes to my new book, If There Is No God, The Battle Over Who Defines Good and Evil. If there is no such thing as evil, in other words, if it's just opinion, that's the problem. If there is no divine source, as our founders said, that we are endowed by our creator, not by our government, not by human beings, by our creator, with certain inalienable rights. Well, the same thing holds for good and evil. If there is a creator who is the source of standards, then there is good and evil. If there is no creator, then all concepts of good and evil are simply personal opinion or societal opinion. Iran qualifies as the quintessence of evil. They, you know, it's amazing that people oppose the president's decision. Iran regularly, I mean weekly, maybe daily, would have demonstrations saying Marg Bar America, death to America, and of course death to Israel. America was the big Satan and Israel was the little Satan. That is what they were devoted to, destroying Israel and destroying America. He doesn't want to let them have that opportunity.
Dennis Prager, our guest, obviously. And Dennis, you said you grew up like a few years after the end of World War II, and you became fascinated with the fact that there was evil in the world, and you thought about the Holocaust. Why would people just want to kill people about a religion or a belief or an ethnicity? And that became your focus. How did that lead you to thinking there was a higher power, as opposed to lead you from that thought?
Because that's a great question, by the way. I don't have a perfect answer, because you're right. It could have led me either way. But I was convinced that the Holocaust Mao's extermination of 60 million Chinese, Stalin's of 20 to 40 million Russians, and 6 million Ukrainians, and so on. I was convinced that it wasn't my opinion that rendered these things evil, that they really were evil. Evil exists. So that led me to believing that there is a moral creator.
Yeah, understood. And then you spend the most of your career and I guess life and free time proving that. What proof did you get that you think there is, and how did that lead to the values that you have?
Well, yeah. The proof is the real life experience of people who suffer from evil. It's very difficult for anyone to assume that there is no evil, that there is just opinion. Very few people believe that. My favorite color, that's opinion. That's not absolute. But the Holocaust and the Chinese famine and so on, induced by Mao, that's real. That's not favorite color.
Understood. I got it. And they go out there and prove it. How does that change your life? When you go out and you go look on these circumstances, you come to your conclusions. Were you somebody that went through a transformation as you came to these conclusions and your thoughts and started writing these books? Were you someone that needed to change, or did this just make you better?
I think it made me better. I wrote in my diary in high school, as a junior in high school, I still have that diary. I wrote, I know my mission in life, my task in life is to influence people to the good. I assumed there was good and evil already in high school. What I've devoted my life to doing is identifying evil and trying to persuade people to combat it. And the association of the United States of America with combating evil, that so many people will use the American flag like they did in Hong Kong when they revolted against the Chinese Communist Party running Hong Kong. Unfortunately, it didn't work, but they used the American flag. For most people, seeing the American flag over the hill, as it were, coming in with the cavalry, meant, wow, we will now have freedom in our country.
It's always great to talk to Dennis. Not many people would be coming back this strong after what happened to him. And without any bitterness, when we come back, what Dennis thinks about his fall, his accident, and how he's responded, and how it fits into his view of America and life and religion. Brian Kilmeade Show.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Dennis Prager, our guest, his book is now out. It's called If There Is No God, The Battle Over Who Defines Good and Evil. So you've got to go grab it. So, Dennis, maybe people at home don't understand like you understand how unbelievably fortunate all these founding fathers were to be educated by the right people and have a certain amount of some of these philosophers around at the same time. Can you explain how the great thinkers of their time influenced our founding fathers like Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson and James Madison?
Well, let me put it to you this way. I cannot explain in normal terms how so many great men were in one place at one time as the founders of the United States of America. And I'll give you an example. I conduct orchestras as an avocation, and I know a lot about classical music. There is no explanation for why Germans in a certain era, Germans and Austrians in a certain era, utterly dominated great music. Beethoven, Bach, Schubert, Schumann, Mozart, Haydn. It's unbelievable. It seems that either God or nature gives a certain group of people a unique ability at a certain place at a certain time. That's why America was founded. And as Benjamin Franklin, I think it was, said, it's a republic. He was asked by a woman, what is it? And he said, it's a republic if you can keep it. And that's a big question. Mm-hmm. Can we keep it?
And yeah, David Hume, you have Rousseau, you had Montesquieu, you had John Locke. These are people that our founding fathers interacted with and almost took the best of their philosophies, let alone the classics of Aristotle and Plato. And they're in their 30s outside Benjamin Franklin, all coming together to say, okay, if we're going to do this, we're going to need fighters, but we're also going to need a philosophy and a governing principle. So they went to school on all these governments. And then we come up with one, pretty effective, eventually a constitution, pretty awesome. And that's how we got here. So I'm always been in awe of it. The PragerU reflects that. You can see it on a daily basis. Why does this generation, more than any others, not understand how special this country is?
Another great question. They have no knowledge of history. That's a big factor. If it happened before they were born, it almost didn't happen.
I know.
I'm sure you know. And it's reflected in social media. It's only what's happening now matters. So they don't have a sense of what is important and what happened before. I think it was Pew Research, or Gallup, noted that almost 50% of young Americans did not know what the Holocaust was.
Wow. And you don't know what percentage denied it happened. And that's also what Iran brought to the world, too. They tried to expound on that.
That's right. Yeah. You know your stuff.
What do you say to people that say religion is a way to control the population? It's a way to give people values and feel of afterlife retribution to keep the house in order, to keep a country in order, to keep a town in order. What do you say to people who say that leaders use religion as an instrument?
It's true. I have no problem with that. And I believe in that instrument. I believe it exists. I wish, in fact, that every country would say to its citizens that if you do evil, you will pay for it in the afterlife. Clearly, very few people pay for it in this life. So I have no problem. It should be used, but it isn't used. That's one of the points of my book, that it's just rendered subjective opinion. So it's not used.
Yeah, whether it's a cynical way to keep the population in order or a legitimate way. So if Dennis Prager was president, it would be a legitimate way. Other people might do it as cynically to keep the house in order, to say, listen, you don't listen to me, but what about an afterlife? That should get your attention. And that's maybe how it's been used in the past. So when you go to prove there is a God, if you would have summed that up in a way in which the non-PhD student would understand, how fundamentally do you get that point across quickly and efficiently?
Well, there are two separate questions. The necessity of God and the existence of God.
Yep.
I have spent much of my life speaking about the necessity. But if you're asking about the existence, I cannot rationally, and I emphasize rationally, explain the existence of anything let alone consciousness, the human being. The idea that the universe came from nothing. The notion that something came from nothing. I mean, if we found a computer on Jupiter, wouldn't we assume that an intelligence put it there? Well, that's us. We human beings on Earth, we are the computer on Jupiter. And intelligence doesn't come from non-intelligence, just as existence doesn't come from non-existence. So that's, in a nutshell, the argument for God's existence. But my emphasis, as I have said, has been on God's necessity. No God, no good and evil, no ultimate justice.
Understood. So, Dennis, for you personally, and by the way, his book is now out, as you know, the book is now out, and If There Is No God, The Battle Over Who Defines God, Good and Evil is out, and you could always order it at Dennis Prager. So, Dennis, you went away for a while. I heard you had an accident. Could you tell everyone what happened?
Well, I advise everybody to read my Wall Street Journal op-ed I don't remember what day, it was about a week ago. And I explain there, on November 12th, 2024, I fell in my house and I was rendered immediately paralyzed from the shoulders down. So my life radically changed. But I have not become depressed, let alone suicidal. And I explain why. And it's gotten a lot of... It's gone viral for good reason, by the way. And I'm not bragging. And the good reason is it gives people hope and reason who have suffered. Obviously, I'm not talking as well as I did prior to the accident, but I am speaking, and I put out videos at PragerU every other week, and I've been on a number of shows like yours, for which I'm very grateful, Brian. Absolutely. But it's been life-changing. But you know what? Everything that I did except travel, I can do now. I can give talks via the internet, and I do. I write articles. Just in my paralyzed form, I have finished the book, If There Is No God, and I wrote an article for the Wall Street Journal, and I am giving these talks. This is a blessing that I can do all of this.
And do you ever ask yourself, why do you think this happened to you?
Oh, this will depress a lot of people. It doesn't depress me at all. And a lot of religious people don't agree with me. But I said before, and I've written it up, not just said it, I do believe that there is good luck and bad luck in life. If a family is hit by a drunk driver, it's bad luck. I do not believe that God designed it that way. God allows people to do bad things. That is the way the world works. I fell because there was no friction on the bathroom floor when I was wet and ran towards my sink instead of going carefully or putting down towels. and because of gravity. So when there's no friction and there is gravity, you will fall. I don't believe God designed my fall. I believe God knows my fall. I believe God, well, I'm trying to choose the word, that God is sad about the fall, but he obviously has allowed tens of millions of people to be hurt. That is the nature of the world. One day we'll find out why.
Mm-hmm. Well, they say God doesn't give you anything you can't handle. He obviously thinks you're extremely tough, and he's 100% right. Dennis Prager, congratulations on the book and the inspiration. Nothing stops you, and you're proof of that. And I look forward to your next PragerU video and your next book. Dennis Prager, thanks so much.
Thank you, Brian.
From breaking news to big name guests, Brian brings you insight you won't hear anywhere else. You're listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show. The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade. More to know. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
Yes, and this is going to bend your brain, this story. It happened in Lee County, Florida, and it's a fun story. It's not a true story, but people took it so literally, they had to walk it back. Listen to what happened and listen what took place and why people took this serious, I don't know, but here's the explanation.
If you've been on social media, you may have seen this viral post claiming a Florida man was kidnapped by dolphins and forced to build an underwater city. This post even shows a mugshot of a sunburned man with the words Lee County Sheriff at the bottom. We reached out to the Lee County Sheriff's office. They told us they never arrested the man mentioned in this post, and the deputy in the story doesn't exist. The sheriff's office even joked about this, saying no dolphins were harmed in the making of this rumor.
So, wait a second. So they put out a story that a man was kidnapped by dolphins and forced to build an underground city, and people took it serious?
Well, someone, just a random person, put out this fake story, but made it look very newsy, like this fake news headline on the top, and named a quote-unquote, you know, deputy that didn't exist, and they made it sound like it was real, and it went so viral that the sheriff's department had to put out an announcement saying, this is not true. It is fake news.
Yeah, I see it says, officials told reporters they have no record of such an arrest. And the deputy named to the viral story does not exist. Residents and visitors at Fort Myers and Cape Coral area said the story quickly raised skepticism. You know who I blame? I blame anybody that grew up in the 70s. Because Flipper was fighting crime at that point. He could do anything, literally so much between Aquaman and Flipper. There was so much crime going on in the oceans. So if you grew up in probably 50 or 60 years old or 70, you probably say to yourself, yeah, collies saved children in wells like Lassie, and Flipper stopped crime.
And if you then go 30 years, he can now build an underwater city.
Right. But I mean, this is something Flipper would never do because Flipper was a good dolphin.
True.
And bad dolphins were called killer whales.
There you go. Right. But maybe Flipper, or the alleged Flipper, kidnapped him with good intentions of a great right. city under the water.
Right. And plus, you should never be forced to build an underground city. How do you hold your breath all that time?
I would imagine there's some sort of magical oxygen tank.
Next. So, this is something hysterical. From blacksmithing to needlepoint, young people are embracing grandma hobbies. Droves of young people are turning to tackle these hobbies and activities such as needlework and mahjong as a means of escaping technology and reconnecting with creativity and exploration. This, according to the Associated Press, is a blowback where everybody's on their phones individually. Now, Mahjong is coming back. I actually seen people play that, which is crazy. I have no idea how to do it. It involves math. I have no interest in math. But this gives me hope, because that just shows to show you we're not going to accelerate past all types of old games. We are getting off the treadmill of technology. And there's a pushback between locking your phones up or not bringing them to school, to not using social media to under 15, and now this.
No, I think it's great. You also had such a sense of reward right after you're doing a needlepoint or crocheting and blacksmithing. I mean, those are also things.
Blacksmithing, isn't that horseshoes?
I mean, Yes, but I would imagine maybe it's also something else that doesn't always involve horses, because that is a very specific craft.
Like, for example, you have a horse.
I do.
Right? So who changes the horse's shoes?
Josh. He's amazing.
Right. So he will pop the shoes off. He's a blacksmith?
He is.
Right. What do they do besides horseshoes?
Well, I mean, no, he is very specialized with the horses and the shoes and making sure they're
feet. What else do blacksmiths do?
What else could they do? I mean, they'll sometimes take the
shoes.
I think as like a... They'll order them, but then they'll shape them to specifically fit the foot. And they'll also have like pads with them, and every horse is different.
Are we sure the horses don't feel pain?
Their hooves are sort of like our nails. Like if you put something in like the top of our nails, you're clipping your nails. That's essentially it.
Really? They don't feel the nails? You actually hit nails into shoes on horses?
Well, you hit, the nails through the shoe into their hoof. But it would be as if, like, when people get their nails done, they get the, like, fun little rings on their nails, similar to that.
Okay. Now, did, like, the old days have horse shoes?
Probably. In the very beginning, they probably just, like, clipped them without putting the shoes on.
Because I would not think a horse needs help. Like, I would think a horse, like a rhino.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if, you know, a horse and rhinos, I didn't think need shoes. Right?
Well, yeah, but it's also then what they get used to, right? If you never put shoes on them, sometimes they're fine. But then once you start putting shoes on them, their feet get a little, you know, they need
really?
Them. Yeah, there's some horses that go barefoot.
Why do elephants not need shoes? Because, I mean, all that weight on their feet.
That's a good point. They have really large feet to absorb the weight. But maybe if you put shoes on them, they then would need shoes going forward.
And would it be called a blacksmith?
Maybe if they used metal.
Next. Bruce Springsteen faces growing criticism over sky-high ticket prices for his anti-Trump democracy tour launch. Now, a couple of things. I'm done with Bruce Springsteen, number one. Number two is he doesn't care. He doesn't want you to come if you don't like Trump, right? So he's like Rachel Maddow of music. His best buddy is Barack Obama. So why are you going?
I mean, the Jersey folk, I mean, there is something about Springsteen, like, in your core. It's still fun. You just
but if you're a Republican, you can't go see him anymore,
you
right?
still enjoy the music.
Thanks for listening.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest-growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone, from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, heard around the country, around the world. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. Thanks so much for being here. This hour, I'm going to be joined by Stuart Vardy. I really think we need an economic perspective on this war. I think it's going exceedingly well. Our military has exceeded expectations. I cannot believe how advanced it is. The weaving in of AI is going to be written about for generations. We also have this brand new precision strike missile. It's better. It's the more accurate HIMAR launch weapon that, believe it or not, is cheaper. It's called, I think they call it a PRISM. It's an acronym. They're deploying. It's a low-cost unmanned combat attack system. It only costs about $35,000 each. They also modeled it after the Iran Shahed drones. Why not? They're out there with one-way strike drones. I told you already, had a chance to go to Germany, and they say that the Ukraine-Russia war has been a laboratory for modern warfare. This is one of the things we picked up and engineered. The Ukrainians are great. They're helping out the five Gulf states on missile defense and how to knock down these drones without using Patriot batteries. CENTCOM confirmed the first combat use of the precision strike missile. Keep in mind, I don't know what it looks like, but the ATACMS are now replaced. We have extra. Can we get them to Ukraine, being that they're no longer at the cutting edge? Also, what got me really pumped up is we're using laser technology. They're called the Helios laser system aboard Navy destroyers. So they were able to stop with, besides, I guess the weakness is cloud cover and rain, but on clear skies in the Gulf, it's a lot of times it is. Most of the times it is. They're able to knock these out with just basically these drones by throwing heat at them. This is unbelievable. And it's cheap and affordable. This is happening in real time. The other thing that happened in real time is a New York City terror attack. We have a mayor that won't even acknowledge it. It was bizarre. It took a while for me to fully understand what was happening on Saturday. A lot of it caught on camera. But you have an there was a protest led by some right-wing guy who was saying that he feels New York City's being taken over by Muslims. So he's protesting. And there's a counter protest to him. Out come these two bombers, 18 and 19-year-old. They're born here. They're American citizens. One's from Turkey, one's from Afghanistan. Get this. Not even knowing each other, came together from Pennsylvania in order to put together an IED they thought was a hoax. It wasn't. Wasn't a smoke bomb. And toss it and hope to explode and cause major damage. They, in their words, wanted to be bigger bombers than the Boston bombers. So the mayor hears about this. Here are his remarks. Condemning white supremacy, cut nine.
On Saturday, a protest was held outside Gracie Mansion, where I live with my wife, Rama. Neither of us were home at the time. This was a vile protest rooted in white supremacy entitled Stop the Islamic Takeover of New York City. I'm the first Muslim mayor of our city. Anti-Muslim bigotry is nothing new to me, nor is it anything new for the 1 million or so Muslim New Yorkers who know this city as our home.
Okay. I can't even listen to this. So you understand, whatever you think of the protests, kind of saying that New York's being taken over by Muslims, whatever you think of that, would I ever do that? No, not in a million years. It was peaceful. They were doing nothing wrong. They didn't like the idea it was there, but he says they have every right to do it. The story is not the peaceful protesters. The story is what happened next. The anti-protesters from the right-wing guy, this guy, Jake something or other, I really don't want to give him more publicity. These are the terrorists that showed up. Their names are some bizarre names, Balat and Kayumi, both charged federally with five counts, including attempted provision of material support and resources to a designated foreign terrorist organization. These two showed up, made it clear they were doing the work of ISIS. They were influenced by ISIS, whatever ISIS does, whether it's downloads or websites or whatever. They were decided to on ISIS to support ISIS by making homemade devices that thankfully did not explode, hurl them at Jake Lang and the far-right activists, and right by Gracie Mansion. Well, it turns out these were extremely dangerous IEDs that thankfully they didn't know what they were doing, and they didn't actually blow up. That's the story. You could say your Muslim religion, they did in the name of Islam and ISIS. You're Muslim. You're telling everyone you're Muslim. Do they represent you and the religion that you know? Maybe this might be a great time, Mayor, to come up and say, listen, it's a peaceful religion. I don't know what these guys are doing. But he doesn't say that. Cut 10.
Let me also be clear about something else. New York City will never tolerate violence, whether from protests or counter-protests. Many of the counter-protesters met this display of bigotry peacefully, with a vision of a city that is welcoming to all. But a few did not. Two men, Amir Balat and Ibrahim Kayumi, traveled from Pennsylvania and attempted to bring violence to New York City. They are suspected of coming here to commit an act of terrorism. There is video of these two individuals throwing two devices towards the protest. The police department has determined that these were improvised explosive devices made to injure, maim, or worse. And let me say this plainly. Anyone who comes to New York City to bring violence to our streets will be held accountable in accordance with the law.
Good. What's missing? Their ideology that they did it for, that they asked for a piece of paper to write down what they stood for. Just like that terrorist that showed up from Senegal in Austin and killed those people in cold blood wearing an Allah sweatshirt. This guy's telling you, I am a terrorist. Please take this down. Here's the commissioner, Jessica Tisch, saying what Mondami should have, cut 11.
As alleged, both defendants have admitted that they acted on Saturday because of ISIS. As Kayumi was being placed into an NYPD vehicle following his arrest, a person in the crowd asked why he had done this. As shown on NYPD body-worn camera footage referenced in the complaint, Kayumi responded with ISIS. And at the precinct, after being advised of his Miranda rights and waiving those rights, Kayumi said in recorded post-arrest statements that he had watched ISIS propaganda on his phone and that his actions that day were partly inspired by ISIS.
Well, first off, Commissioner, thank you for being honest. Instead of saying, according to reports, they wrote things on paper that said they were, and then have people counter that. She just lays it out. Why can't the mayor lay that out? Why Bloomberg would have. Giuliani would have. Just lay it out and say, hey, I'm a Muslim. I don't do this. And they're destroying the reputation of my religion. But instead, you separate the two. Listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Important story. And let's just hope there aren't more like this. Listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. We're back in a moment.
Don't go anywhere. Brian Kilmeade will be right back. Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, we are back. And everybody, I don't have to remind you that it's year 250 of America's birth. And it's time to celebrate and look back at this remarkable journey. Sadly, some people don't want to do that journey. But it's also 25 years since the 9/11 attack, same time. Coming up on September 11th, that'll mark those 25 years. Patrick McGarry is not waiting for that. Beginning on March 8th on Sunday, he'll be actually doing a bike ride, starting a bike ride from San Diego. And he'll be taking a full day of rest here and there. But he's been going to different places, raising awareness after his sister and many of people that he knew were in those attacks and lost their lives that day. He'll be stopping in Tucson, Arizona on the 14th. On March 23rd in Marfa, Texas. On the 30th, Fredericksburg, Texas. On the 6th, DeRidder, Los Angeles, Louisiana. And Gulf Shores, Alabama. And he's looking to raise money for a goal of $100,000 for T2T.org. That's Tunnel to Towers. With us right now is the man doing that bike ride, training for it, Patrick McGarry. Patrick, welcome.
Brian, thanks for having me.
Hey, Patrick, first tell us, you're all over this World Trade Center story, but it's not necessarily just about 9/11. Let's go back to 93. Where were you when the first bombing took place?
1993, I was working on the 96th floor for a Japanese investment bank, I was there on February 26th at 12:16 when the first attack happened, and it was a day that changed my life. It took me a long time to completely understand how it changed it, but it was also the beginning of the end of my career on Wall Street. I did not go back to work after we returned to the building. So it was a significant event in my life, and I felt lucky that I got out, but also had impacts on me as well.
But I mean, you had inhaled a lot of smoke. You were sick afterwards too, right?
I was. After the attack happened, I did go to the hospital twice. I had some, I just had some breathing issues, and it was just a kind of a strange day. We didn't have internet. We didn't have cell phones. So we were just kind of hanging out up there without really fully understanding everything that was happening.
And in retrospect, that was the precursor to 9/11. But you decided not to go back. And by the way, you're doing a 3,000 miles across the United States to honor the memory of your sister, Katie, who lost her life at the World Trade Center that day. So you were not at Wall Street anymore and not in the World Trade Center, but your sister was. And the circumstances are so unfortunate and crazy. What led her to the top floor of the World Trade Center that day?
So Katie had just started a new job with a financial tech company called Telecurs USA, which is now Six Financial. And her office was located in Stamford, Connecticut. And Katie had just gotten married in April of that year, which is the last time we were all together. And her husband, Brad, worked for Lehman Brothers on the 37th floor of the North Tower. And kind of sadly, the day before 9/11, Katie was asked to attend the Risk Waters Technology Conference at Windows on the World. And, on that day, she, instead of going to Connecticut, she and her husband took the path into the Trade Center. He escorted her up to the express elevator, gave her a kiss goodbye, and she walked into world history and got there 10 minutes before the plane hit. And my brother-in-law was able to get out. So the fact that she was there was something that I could not accept then. And I still can't believe it today, but it's just the way it went down. And she's missed every day.
She's missed every day. And you lost other people. You lost a cousin. And didn't you lose some other friends of yours?
I did. I lost my cousin, John. He was a broker at Cantor Fitzgerald, John Farrell. I counted, by the time I got back to Long Island and all the funerals we were going to, there were over 40 people. I had about six former coworkers. I had probably 12 people from Chaminade and Fairfield University, and a bunch from my parish in New York. And I think you remember during that time, everybody that worked on Wall Street, it was kind of a very small, tight community. And they were just, it was an overwhelming thing to accept all that loss. And, you know, I was at a 60th birthday party in Morristown, New Jersey, a couple of years ago, and I drove up to it and with some of my former coworkers from Yamaichi, and I found a story of another person that I didn't even know, and it just kind of went to the I just couldn't accept anymore. I didn't want to hear anymore. It was just too much to process, and there were just it was just a lot of people.
So, and still to this day, but one way you have figured out a way to give tribute, give recognition, and help and raise money is this bike ride. Tell me about it.
So, my biking started during COVID. I guess like everybody else, I was going crazy. You know, I spent most of my life on a trading floor, and then I found myself locked in my office at home, and I started riding my bike. Last April, I told my wife, as my biking was picking up after I retired, I said, next year is the 25th anniversary of 9/11. And, you know, I want to remember my sister and I want to do something meaningful. And, but I also want something good to come out of it. And that's where Tunnel to Towers came in. And that morning that I was watching on TV in Montana, when it happened, it was just so frustrating not to be there to help. And then to understand that there was somebody like Steven Siller and others that were trying to help. I just knew that this was the mission to raise the money, that my sister, it's like a thank you letter, I think, that she wanted me to write for our first responders and our military, and their mission to me, it speaks deeply to my family and I. These people run to danger when everyone else is running away. And I think it's, to me, this ride is an honor to support people that are with us at our worst moment in life. And I'm going to help, my sister and I are going to help stand with them during their worst moment.
And nobody, yeah, no one's done better than Tunnel to Towers to keep the memory of that day alive and the people that lost their lives that day. I mean, they're just a phenomenal organization. So how does it work? If people want to support you on the ride and support the physical toll it's going to be taking on you, how do they do it?
So my wife set up a website for me about 6 months ago, and it's www.aridetoremember2026.com. And I'm working closely with Tunnel to Towers. So on that website, there's a story of what happened with Katie. It's a story of my involvement. And people can donate on that website. And the way it's set up, the money goes directly to Tunnel to Towers. So I work with them on a daily basis. I have a blog in there that I'll be writing on medium.com throughout my journey, explaining each day. I'll probably be dedicating a day of my ride to many of the people that I lost. And, you know, it's like I said, it's just an honor. And I would be grateful for anyone that would stand with us on this mission.
Yeah, so beginning March 8th, Patrick McGarry will be honoring the memory of all those who lost their lives, especially his sister, who lost her life in the World Trade Center that day, almost 25 years ago. And your goal is $100,000. How close are you?
Right now, I'm at $88,000. So I need $12,000 more. And, you know, Brian, I got a donation the other day from a complete stranger for $9.11. And that just seemed to start a trend on the website. And so I've gotten anonymous. These people that I know, people that I don't know. A lot of people have called me and shared stories with me. So I'm grateful for any support that we get.
And for you personally, does it help you wrap your head around it that day to go do something so positive?
Yes. I think turning pain into purpose is a connection for me. Throughout the last year of all the training, I've ridden over 7,000 miles in preparation for this. And Brian and I found out one thing, that grief is kryptonite. And if you properly tap into that pain, I have found that you can do a lot of things. And for me, this is the healthiest way to respond to it. But as I said, it's the honor of a lifetime to be able to support Tunnel to Towers in this way.
So your ride's going to begin in San Diego, California, conclude 44 days later in St. Augustine. You can track Patrick McGarry, so it's M small c capital G A A R Y, his ride to commemorate 25 years since 9/11, which it's going to be a big deal. They've done a very good job in downtown New York City remembering that day. And you know, the president doesn't have to be reminded. He was in New York City that day and went down to, in a couple of days, he was down there, or the next day, was down there after 9/11. So go help them out. And one more time, Patrick, the website?
www.aridetoremember2026.com.
Okay. Patrick, best of luck. I'm sorry you're going through this, but it's great to see someone making something so positive out of something so negative. Patrick McGarry, I'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you, Brian. I appreciate it.
You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. We can't talk about the war and not talk about the economy. And if you want to talk about the economy and you're in by 1211 6th Avenue, it's 1-800 Stuart Varney. Stuart Varney, the Varney and Company, the wildly successful show, the top show in business news. Great to see you, Stuart.
Good to be here, Brian.
Well, you and I, by the way, we're defying all logic as the best-dressed people in the history of radio. I mean, look at that blazer of yours, a beautiful tie, and look at me.
This is a sports jacket that makes me look like a Midwestern banker, and I'm rather proud of it.
Yes, you do. You come off just like a Midwestern banker. First off, to see oil go over $100 a barrel and go way over that and then come down, back and up, back and forth, what are you thinking?
Well, look, there's political danger here, and there's economic danger. The price of oil goes to $100 a barrel, and up goes the price of gas. That's a very important thing.
About 40 cents? Would you say 40 cents?
So far, up about 40 cents. You've gone well above 350. It could be that you'll get to $4 a gallon by the end of this week. That's not out of the question. Now, that's got political problems attached to it. The price of gas is very important in the United States. Nobody wants to see $4 gas, and they'll blame the president for this, and that blame will rub off into the midterms. So you've got economic political problems there, but you've got economic problems too, because gas at $3.50, $4 a gallon raises the price of
everything.
So we'll add to inflation. Now, later this week, there's going to be the latest consumer price index released. That will probably not relate too much to $100 a barrel oil, but it will be a factor because prices have been rising. That means you've got a rise in inflation. Its odds are you're not going to get interest rate cuts. Mortgage rates are not likely to come down. The Fed is not going to lower rates. So you've got political problems, $4 gas. You've got economic problems, $4 gas, inflation.
Got to get Kevin Warsh in there, right? To get Jay Powell out.
Yes, well, that's not going to happen until May. Then you could expect them to probably lower interest rates, but that's in May. That's a long way off.
I want you to hear the Secretary of the Interior, who's got energy in his portfolio, Doug Burgum, cut 30.
This is a temporary issue. This is not about lack of oil in the world. This is about a transit issue. This is about the Strait of Hormuz. And with the great success that our military is having, along with our allies, with Epic Fury, you're going to see in the weeks ahead, oil starting to flow out of the Strait of Hormuz.
And we already saw a frigate go through over the weekend. And you know what the president said? Suck it up.
Yeah.
Get tough.
Yeah.
Go through there. I've taken out almost all the launchers. I've taken out their entire Navy. Go through.
I agree with the secretary.
And he's also given insurance.
Yes, you've got insurance and you've got some escort for these for the boats going through. Look, I think it will be relatively short-lived because there's so much pressure. Get those tankers through the Straits of Hormuz. You think the Chinese are happy that the oil that's on its way to China
is getting
held up? What, do they
get 40% through there?
Right, but 20% of the world's oil supply comes through there. Do you think Europeans are happy? A lot of their nat gas supply comes through the Straits of Hormuz. You think the Gulf states are happy? They've shut down production. They're not getting any income from that. They haven't got enough storage space left. So the pressure to just open up those straits, get things going, is enormous.
Do you know we get 3%? You know this. We get 3% of our oil through there. We kind of do our own thing now, unlike the 70s.
Yes, the trouble is that the oil is a world market. You know, you can't just price it according to the price is coming out of Texas. No, you've got to price it as the world supply and demand. And at the moment, it's $100 a barrel. That creates enormous pressure. Get that price down, get those straits opened, and I think that pressure will result in action.
So do you think people, judging, because you know the political fray too, you do a lot of politics in your show. By the fall, if those prices come down by the end of this month, are people going to remember, well, March was tough for 3 weeks? Or are they going to say, well, you know, it's back down to 220 because all the thresholds are there, right? The natural gas production, the drilling is there, the permits are there.
I think the American public, if we get this done by the end of the month and prices come down, I think the American public will say it's worth it. Short-term pain, it's worth it because look what we got. We've got the end of a rogue regime that's been causing trouble for a half century. We have peace throughout the Middle East. We haven't seen that in 50 years. What the price we pay is significant, but what the reward that we get is enormous. And I think it will be concluded in about 4 to 6 weeks.
You know, so interesting. I've been watching a lot. When I get in the morning, you and I have basically the same hours. So I get in the morning, I've seen all the shows already. So I'm always watching Sky TV or GBN News. I'm always getting the British perspective. And they're kind of freaked out that they have basically 2 days of natural gas, that their prime minister is trying to say, legally, I can't help you. And what happened to that special relationship between the U.S. and U.K.? And instead of just dumping on Trump, I think they all had a reality check. Can you give me a perspective on what's going on?
The prime minister is Sir Keir Starmer, and he has a large majority in parliament. Unfortunately, he's just wasted it away. He's not taken the right action in a number of circumstances, and now he was late to get on board with Trump. Don't do that. That's the worst thing you can do. You don't stare our president in the face and say, well, I'm sorry, we can't help you right now. Don't do that. He's under enormous pressure. I think it's quite possible he will lose his job. There's so much discontent in Britain for all kinds of things. Free speech under attack in Britain like you wouldn't believe. There's an anti-Muslim operation going on there, which is...
People trying to get their country back, their country
identity.
Yes, they
want to get their country back. There's a crisis of identity.
Isn't that remind you of
Britain
us?
All about?
Doesn't that remind you of us in 2017? In the beginning, they said, oh, you're xenophobic, we're a nation of immigrants. And now people are like, oh, yeah, I do want to make sure we keep our national identity. I am for strong borders. Is Europe just a little bit, when they used to lead us, are they a little bit behind us?
Well, you got to remember, in France, Germany, and Britain, there is a very substantial Muslim minority which exercises political power. Now, if the French, Germans, or the Brits go too far towards beating up Iran or beating up Trump, then what you get is the local Muslims reacting to that and opposing them politically. And just a quick example. There was what we call a by-election in Britain recently. That is a special election for a member of parliament. It just came out of nowhere. In that election, the Green Party won. Second with the Reform Party, the Conservatives. Third was the Labour government. Why did the Green Party manage to win like this? Answer, 1/4 of the people who voted in that election were Muslim. And they vote solidly against Trump and against America. That's what happened.
Yeah, and that's pretty much what's happening here. The DSA has teamed with Muslims and teamed with liberals in order to be part of the Democratic Party. But if you ask me, these are three different platforms. You would think traditional liberal is like a Bill Maher guy, you know, and then traditional liberal is like a Cuomo guy. You know, when you go, oh, I don't agree with these socialist programs and maybe taxes are too high. Those are the old days.
Yes.
But now we're like, I don't really like America too much.
Right.
I don't think we should have billionaires. Really? Yeah. And you're chanting against America because of free speech? That's different than the Democratic-Republican debate than you and I used to talk about.
The Democrat Party has shifted far to the left. It's obvious. I mean, none of them would stand up in Congress at the State of the Union address. None of them would stand up when the president said, stand up for the rights of American citizens. They sat down. They just kept seated. Now, that don't make them look good, in my opinion. That, you know, the days where hate America first, they should be coming to an end.
I would think so. But
it should.
Back to one thing. This must really get under your skin. And the president alerted me to this. They stopped drilling off the North Sea.
Yep.
That you have natural gas and oil off, not you anymore, you're an American citizen, but the UK has natural gas and oil off the North Sea.
Yeah,
now, everyone's breaking out of the green fever and going to nuclear or whatever and say, okay, wait a second, we're going to need some coal. And we still have Starmer looking elsewhere with 2 days of reserves of natural gas, knowing in the North Sea is the answer to his problems.
There are very few countries where the green feeling, the green fever, as you call it, was stronger than in Britain. Those folks are deep, deep green. The King of England is, he's a king. That's what he did. For many, many years, the Greens could do no wrong in Britain. And that included ending North Sea oil and gas production. I mean, can you believe there's huge reserves there?
Right.
They said, no, we don't want any more fossil fuels. Sorry, can't have that. That was a mistake of cataclysmic proportions. Now we're paying for it.
All right, Seward, I want to come back and talk about if that's going to change. Here's my big worry. I think the fever is broken, the political correctness, the pronouns is broken, and then people are pushing back on me saying, Brian, it's only broken because Trump's in office, and if there's something switches, it's going to go right back. I don't believe that. I want to get your take when we return. Listen to Brian Kilmeade Show, the host of Varney & Company. He didn't bring his company. He brought himself. 9 to noon on FBN. Back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade. Show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I understand from talking to Secretary Wright, our energy secretary, that one, what they call Suez Max, which is a super tanker, has moved, and we're asking the rest to follow suit. We'll give them the protection they need, and we are knocking the snot out of Iran's capabilities. But again, one more reason why we had to do it now and not wait until they had even additional capability to not just hold the region hostage, but the world's energy supplies. Enough is enough. They've been doing this for 47 years. They started this war 47 years ago. Thank God President Trump is doing what's necessary to end it.
Stuart Varney with us right now, talking about the economic hit with Iran is temporary. Stuart, the one thing I got to give the president credit for, he cares so much about the economy, dollars and cents. It got him elected. It's how he was brought up, everything, dollars. How could I do this the cheapest way possible and put the best deal together possible? And he's doing this for the greater good. I'm going to suck it up in a time in which my administration just told me the stats show and the polls reveal that the people care most about affordability in the economy. And he's straining the pocketbooks temporarily for a chronic problem that's lasted almost five decades. That shows to me a leadership maturity.
Yes, it does. He's not just talking about it. He's doing it. He realizes that you have this opportunity. This opportunity created by him, but it is an opportunity to rid the world of a major threat. And he's saying, you will pay a price for this, a short-term price, but it is worth it. Mm-hmm. And that's leadership, isn't it? That's leadership. That's saying, this is worth it to achieve that goal. Little bit of pain, okay, but we're going to achieve it. This is me.
Yeah, when we went to break, I was just bringing this up. You know, so when we're talking about the next advent of energy, if the Democrats get in control, let's say they grab the White House, are they going to get it by saying, bring back solar panels, bring back electric cars, I want to get subsidies, and I want to be political correctness?
No.
Or are they going to not say that, but yet do it when they get into power? Where do you think they're heading?
I think the climate thing has flown. I think that train has left the station. That would be my opinion. And any attempt to bring it back, you know, restrictions on fossil fuels, whether they say they're going to do it or they wait until they're in power to do it, it's not going to fly. I think America's come a long way from that, a long way beyond that. The Green New Deal is dead.
Stu,
and how could you just bring it back? You think you could get legislation in Congress that put restrictions on power output using fossil fuels? You're never going to do that.
Well, especially with these data centers, the advent of AI, you just can't power it. Are you just going to be a country without AI? It's going to be impossible. I love that the president said, hey, guys, Meta, you're going to build AI, ChatGPT. You're going to build your own power stations.
Right.
I love that.
Exactly right.
Yeah, I love that because states can't handle utility costs. When utility costs go up, it's really on the state.
Right.
But yet the president's getting blamed that utility costs are going up.
Yeah.
So
there's no justice sometimes, is there?
But look at California. California hasn't changed anything. They still have that mandate to get rid of gas-powered cars by 2035. You're not supposed to sell them. You can't have them. They still prefer to go to South America and Iraq to get their oil and gas, even though they have the reserves. So aren't they a mini island of political correctness?
They are. As a matter of fact, it's about to get worse in California. Governor Newsom is adjusting the rules on emissions from refineries. The result is refineries in California are closing. They're down to about one that's left. When that one goes, they reckon that the price of gasoline in California will go up maybe a dollar a gallon. It's already over $5 a gallon in California. Can you imagine $6? But they're going to do it. They're going to go through with it. There's still people in California who believe that the world is going to end, that the climate crisis is upon us, we must get rid of fossil fuels. That is a declining point of view. I don't think it's shared widely. Right. And if Newsom wants to be the president of the United States on a climate agenda, he can forget about it. It's not going to happen.
Well, he still says that Joe Biden was a great president. He'll stand by everything he's done. So the New York, it's interesting what Kathy Hochul's doing. Now, she's doing it because the election's coming up. We already had that dry run when it came to congestion pricing, remember? She's running for re-election. There will be no congestion pricing in New York City after the election. She beats Lee Zeldin barely, but we have congestion pricing. Now she's saying, wow, Governor Cuomo left me an impossible mandate when it comes to shutting down Indian Wells nuclear plant, not allowing pipelines in, the whole mini California agenda. She's looking to unravel it with a left-wing legislature in Albany, New York. Number one, is that necessary? Is this window dressing? Do you believe it?
She's playing politics. I mean, if she wants to get reelected, and she does, you've got to accommodate the new feeling in town. I think she'll tax the rich. I think that's what the Democrats will turn to. Mondami wants her to. And she realizes that she may have to. I think tax the rich is the mantra being picked up by the whole Democrat Party, because there's an element of jealousy here. Billionaires have gotten an enormous amount of publicity. A lot of people are frustrated that some people can make so much. That is our system, but nonetheless, it brings some frustration. It's an easy slogan. Tax the billionaires. Tax the millionaires, tax the billionaires. It's such an easy thing.
But Stuart, even Governor Newsom does not want a billionaire's tax, and he's already seen an exodus. As you know, the last one is Zuckerberg is going to Miami. We see the aerial shots of his place. You have one billionaire after another leaving in real time from California, and Newsom's not even supporting the proposition that's on the ballot in November. So do you believe it's still got legs?
The wealth tax?
Yeah.
Yeah, that is going to be on the ballot in California. They'll get the signatures required.
They're going to lose all their billionaires. They're going to lose the wealthy.
Well, they've got an army of lawyers to protect them. Just because a couple of them go to Miami doesn't mean to say that all of their wealth has gone with them and all their income has gone with them. That's not the point. That's not what's happening.
Before you go, when it comes to investment income, the way, like, if I go and invest in a bunch of houses, you see my money, you see my revenue, and I get taxed.
Yep.
But if I have investment income, which I have very little cash on, whether I'm Jeff Bezos, he doesn't really have much cash. He has it in stocks. He doesn't pay any tax until he cashes out.
These guys don't pay income tax.
Are you okay with that?
Am I okay with that? Yes. I don't want to see anybody taxed on an item, on an investment, like a stock, for example, which they haven't yet sold and made a profit on. That's the California wealth tax. That's what they want to do. 5% off the top from everything you own.
Look at your portfolio. This is the value at the end of the year. Yes. That's what you're being taxed on.
It's not just stocks. It's your house. It's your cars. It's your artwork. It's your land. It's your businesses. We want 5% of that. Wow. Now, that's catastrophic, and I don't think it'll actually happen in reality, but it's going to be on the ballot.
Stuart Varney, what can we expect on your show on Wednesday?
All kinds of stuff about
my business.
The market and the market. Price of oil. You're going to be concentrating on the price of oil. Case closed, Wednesday morning.
Watch the war, watch your pocketbook. It's the same story.
That's what I do for a living.
He is Stuart Varney from Varney & Company. Keep it here. Keep in mind, go to briankilmeade.com. Find out how to see me May 30th in Reno, Nevada. And, of course, on July 11th, not History, Liberty, and Laughs. Now it's Uniting the States, streamed on Fox Nation. Thanks for listening to Brian Kilmeade Show. Keep it here.
News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. We're coming to you from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, where we have a mayor that can't recognize the fact that we had a legitimate Islamic extremist terror attack right by his Gracie Mansion. But he still had Mahmoud Khalil, who's the radical, ungrateful American who was going to Columbia University, yet stayed in campus housing 2 years after he graduated, that we've made a huge effort to deport. But for some reason, it's okay for him to go over to the mayor's house for Ramadan. Meanwhile, there was a terror attack by two guys in their teens, families from Afghanistan and Turkey, respectively, basically pro-ISIS. And with a very formidable IED that, if they put it together with a little bit more skill, would have really done some tremendous damage here in New York City. So it just goes to show you the danger is not in just in the war zone of Beirut, not just in the war zone of sometimes Tel Aviv. We know all over Iran, it is everywhere. But we're getting used to that. Bottom of the hour, Kathy Lee Gifford joins us. Michael Oren is standing by now, former ambassador to the United Nations, a veteran himself. Ambassador joins us from Israel, I think. Right, Ambassador?
Mm-hmm. In Tel Aviv, under intermittent fire here.
Oh, right. So what kind of pace are they at in terms of incoming today?
Well, listen, a week ago it was about 30 a day. Now we're down. This morning had about 3 or 4. Which is we're dealing with it. We have our bomb shelters.
Right. What does it tell? What does it tell you with the lower cadence? Do you think it's a choice, or is it about their stocks, Iran?
The answer to both questions is yes. The answer is yeah, we're hitting their launchers. Yeah, we're hitting their arsenals and their production facilities. But they're always going to save a couple of missiles for rainy days. And all they need is to have one or two of these rockets a day, and that kind of ruins your life. They just you hear it.
Yeah, I heard something.
Can you hear
that? Yeah.
That's the next rocket coming in. Yeah, how about that? I'm going to stay with you as long as I can, okay?
Understand. Understood.
All right. That is a pre-rocket warning. We have actually a pre-rocket warning that comes over our cell phones. You can see it, the writing there. That's telling you to get near a bomb shelter. And that gives you another minute or two. You're going to see. But they're also going to keep – they're also outsourcing. So they got Hezbollah firing at us at the north. And they're going to soon – my guess is when the Hezbollah runs low on missiles, they'll bring in the Houthis and maybe some of those the terrorists that they have in Syria and Iraq. So, you know, they're outsourcing. They're one big terror network. And if I could, Brian, could you say a word about those bombs yesterday in New York, the ISIS terrorists? You know, we tend to distinguish between ISIS and Hamas and Hezbollah and Iran. It can be very confusing, especially if you're not living in this region. They are all the same. They may be Sunni, they may be Shiite, but they have the exact same theology. They aim to recreate the medieval Muslim empire in the Middle East and then expand that realm to the world. They will use the same modus operandi, the same way of completing this vision is through terror, is through genocide, is through propaganda. And what they all have in common, and this is very important for understanding this war, is that they all have the same definition of victory. In order to win, they have only not to lose. And they don't care how many people they get killed, of their own people get killed. And we have to know this is the nature of our enemy. It's a hard one. It's a hard one to wrap your head around if you're not living here.
Right. We did watch ISIS and Iran fight in the aftermath of when President Obama took out all our troops stupidly after the successful surge in Iraq. We watched ISIS come out of nowhere and try to take Baghdad. And it was Iran and the U.S. and the Kurds who pushed them back. That's where when someone comes out for ISIS, you're not necessarily coming back from Iran, but you're saying the bracket is Islamic extremist.
It's a bracket of Islamic extremists. So what's going on in Manhattan is not divorced what's going on, you know, literally in my house tonight. And it's very much linked by a common theology, a common implementation, and a common goal. You know, to win, they only have not to lose.
So I want you to hear what Commissioner Tisch said that these two bombers would be bombers confess to. Cut 12.
The complaint also details statements made by Amir Balat after his arrest. En route to the NYPD precinct, Balat made spontaneous statements without being questioned by NYPD officers that were captured on body-worn camera footage. He said, "This isn't a religion that just stands when people talk about the blessed name of the prophet. We take action, we take action." As well as, "If I didn't do it, someone else will come and do it." And later, after waiving his rights, he requested paper and wrote a message declaring in part, "I pledge my allegiance to the Islamic State. Die in your rage, you kuffar." Now, "die in your rage" is a commonly known ISIS slogan, and "kuffar" is an Arabic term that refers to non-believers.
So they're talking. How rare is that? Because you deal with this every day.
Well, at least they're being honest.
Right. And it's exactly what you just said.
Someone else will do it. Yeah, they're being honest. Give them credit. But what they're saying is not so much different than the leaders of Iran will say, or Hezbollah or Hamas. It's very, very similar. And you're right that if they don't do it, someone else would do it. And here's the good news. I want to leave you some good news, is that, ISIS is still a threat. It's a threat in the Middle East. It's a threat in America. But it's a lot less of a threat since Donald Trump defeated them. And this is true. There are neo-Nazis running around, too. But they're a lot less threatening because there's no German state behind them. So, when the terrorists have a state behind them, like they have in Iran, that's what Hezbollah and Hamas and the Houthis have. They have a state behind them. You take down the state, and these terrorists may still be around, but they can't threaten you in the same way.
So, Ambassador, a couple of things. I want to bring you to an interview I saw you do on CNN yesterday, and I was so glad you said what you said. I want to bring you back to that moment.
We just heard that reporting from our colleague Matthew Chance. We know that an Israeli military spokesperson was asked if Israel was preparing a large-scale ground invasion into Lebanon. He responded, "All options remain on the table." I'm curious what you see as the next steps for Israel in all of this.
Good to be with you, Jessica. Let me just first comment on Matthew Chance's report, a very lengthy report, which somehow did not mention once one of the 220 rockets that Hezbollah has fired at northern Israel in the last 5 days. That has displaced thousands of people, wounded dozens, killed. I mean, if you don't do that, you have not done your job as a reporter.
He is reporting on the ground. Hang on. He is reporting on the ground.
And the exchange, I was just so glad you called it out. Because it's important to report accurately, not sympathetic to either side. But if you're going to be on the ground, report what's happening. Why are you in there? You're getting rocketed. How has this coverage been in this conflict compared to others? Has that happened a lot, what I just witnessed?
Well, you don't have to pick up the New York Times, pick up any newspaper. It's all about the suffering that the United States and Israel are inflicting on the people of Iran, the people of the Middle East. You wouldn't know. You're dealing with an empire which is fundamentally, irredeemably evil, and that they are shelling us nonstop. And, this report, there was a 7-minute item on CNN that talked about all the suffering that Israel is inflicting on the innocent people of Lebanon. And by the way, we do not have a beef with the Lebanese people. We want peace with Lebanon. It's Hezbollah. And didn't mention one rocket. I mean, it was outrageous. I got to tell you, it was outrageous.
I
don't lose it. You know me. I'm kind of diplomatic. Yeah. I don't lose it easily. But that just drove me crazy. And it's terrible journalism, and it's propaganda, and it's creating a situation where the viewers of these reports are thinking to themselves, well, the Israelis just wake up every morning and think nothing else except killing people. And it couches us as fundamentally evil beings. And it's actually has a strategic danger. It's not just PR.
The New York report was done by a CNN reporter of those two Islamic extremist bombers. They led off the fact that they were Islamic extremists, that they were mentioned ISIS, that they were motivated to do this. And then they took the report down. They got so much criticism. But let's not talk about them anymore. Yeah. Let's talk about this. What is it going to break? What is it going to take to break the institutions of this tyrannical, evil government of Iran? Because it looks like the institutions are still holding strong. Big outward display for the new supreme leader. It looks like they still have the Bashij going up and down with motorcycles, making sure the Iranian people don't feel a sense of freedom to turn on their government. What's it going to take to break their back?
Okay, I'm going to be very honest with you about this, all right? I know in the United States, legitimately, there's a tremendous amount of fear about endless wars in the Middle East, forever wars in the Middle East, and their frame of reference is the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan. But I think that's the wrong example, because there are no boots on the ground here. And America can keep up, and Israel can keep up, the aerial campaign until there's no more missiles being fired at anybody. And I don't know how long that takes, but it's not months. It may not even be weeks. But to truly defeat Iran, to weaken the regime to the point where people can rise up and overtake it, or a coup can be mounted from within the regime, is going to take a sustained campaign of pressure. It includes a very tight naval blockade, so not a drop of oil gets out of Iran. And the example here is not Iraq and Afghanistan. It's the Cold War. The Cold War took decades. I'm not saying this is going to take decades, but the Cold War took decades. The United States was strong, and the United States eventually triumphed over the Soviet bloc. And it may take that long because, again, like Hamas, like Hezbollah, the Iran regime doesn't care how many ships you sink. It doesn't care how many supreme leaders you kill. Their one criteria for victory is we survived. We're going to come out of the rubble and we're going to give a V sign and we've survived. And you got to create a situation where they can never claim that they won victory. If the war was to end today, Iran would claim victory. If you ask the people in the Hamas and Gaza whether they won the war after 2 years, you know, and all that destruction, they think they won the war because they're still standing. And so we have to create a situation where they're not still standing. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a military solution. It could be punishing sanctions. It could be a naval blockade and create a situation where nobody can make a rocket launcher anymore. And that could be sustained. And I think that the American people, I believe, would be able to give support for that. Certainly the people of Israel would give it 100% support.
So how important is it to take out this 56-year-old son of the Ayatollah Khomeini, who now has the reins of that country? He looks as evil, they say he's more evil than his dad, that no one's really heard his voice. There's no charisma or Q rating there. But in terms of ruthlessness, I don't think that's an acceptable substitution. Do you?
No, but it's almost irrelevant because it doesn't matter if they put up, you know, John Doe there. If he has exactly the same policy, the same worldview, which we are going to try to recreate this medieval kingdom, and we're going to expand it, you know, to include the world, and we're going to use terror, and we're going to use genocide, we're going to use every possible means of doing that, then, you know, the logical response, the moral response of the United States and Israel has to be to eliminate that individual as well, until such a time as maybe it sinks in that this is not very good for the Iranian people. The Iranian people are talented, ultimately pro-Western people who want prosperity. They do not want to spend $500 billion on a nuclear program, which is now reduced to rubble, or to spend billions for terror, and these terrorist organizations have been reduced, or to build ballistic missiles, again, at billions, the cost of billions, just to threaten neighbors and kill people throughout the Middle East. And maybe there'll be that type of uprising or that type of coup within the actual military that will say, okay, enough, we want a different life.
Ambassador Michael Oren, our guest. So what is your feeling about getting rid of the Karg Island, which is 90% of where the Iranian oil is processed? We could take it quickly. Do you think we should?
I'd be better to take it rather than to blow it up, put it that way. I think that there's a grand strategy here of denying major oil supplies to China. It started with Venezuela. It's now moved into Iran. 90% of the Iranian oil goes to China. And if you're looking for pressure points on China, this is a great way to do it.
What is it going to take to give people security going through the Strait of Hormuz? I'm hearing from military officials it's going to be a few more days because we've got to get rid of all rocket launchers that could send something maybe 200 miles into the Strait.
I think the escort idea is a great idea. And, you know, going back to World War II, where the U.S. Navy escorted convoys going to Great Britain, it kept Britain going during the Battle of Britain and after. It's a tried and true method of doing it. And I think it's, I don't want to overuse the term, it's the moral response to keep oil flowing through there, escort those tankers.
Do you think it's possible? Do we have the naval assets?
I think you do. They're going to get more of them. You know, America has 11 aircraft carriers. There are two of them now in the vicinity.
Three. Yeah.
Or three, one heading there, right?
Yeah.
So there's a lot more assets out there we can use. But you make convoys. You put them in convoys. And the destroyers, the cruisers, have a tremendous amount of anti-missile technology and interceptors on their ships. And they can use them. Now, that's not foolproof. And you have to keep on all the time diminishing and degrading Iran's missile capacity. And this is where the Houthis will probably come into. They'll start shooting eventually.
Why do you think they're waiting? Why do you think the Houthis are waiting?
They're waiting for a time when maybe Iran is running a little bit low on their missiles. And because, again, they're the same way. Their definition of victory is they're still standing. You can bomb them. You bomb the smithereens. I mean, the Trump administration really bombed them very, very heavily. And we've bombed them. They don't care. As long as someone can press a button on a missile launcher, they're still in business. So you have to hit them very, very hard again and again and again. Now, America has a lot more firepower in the region than it had 2 years ago. So this can be brought to bear. It's not pretty. It's not easy. But I think it's necessary.
It is necessary. There's no doubt about it. Ambassador, yeah. Anybody that got a newspaper delivered over this last 47 years knows Iran has been at the head of the terror list, and nobody else was confronting him except for you guys and now us. And now we're together. And there's there's no two better fighting forces in the world than Israel and the U.S. So hopefully we achieve all the goals. Ambassador Michael Oren, stay safe.
Nick, Brian, thank you so much.
You got
Thank you so much for your support.
You got it. 1-866-408-7669.
It's Brian Kilmeade. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. Bottom of the hour, Kathy Lee Gifford is going to be joining us in studio. That'll be great. Meanwhile, just a note about what's going on over in Australia. The Iranian soccer team is over there playing a match, it might be in a tournament. They did not sing during the national anthem. Broadcaster over there said all of them should be put in jail. And immediately, Australia is giving them an offer of asylum at our urging, too. I'm not saying they wouldn't have done it on their own. But five said, yes, we defect. And the others are showing signs they want to defect. But the handlers are dragging them onto the bus and maybe in the airport by now. Some Australians are trying to jump in front of that bus and stop the bus from going forward. Meanwhile, they know that if they go, some of them say, we'd like to leave, but you're going to torture us, our family, if we did. Wouldn't this be a great moment for Megan Rapinoe and others to say, this stand up for women's sports and women's soccer in particular? You know, the one who says, I don't mind trans men in women's sports. Wouldn't this be a great moment for soccer players to stand up with soccer player, female athlete to stand up with female athlete? I don't hear a word from them. I mean, this is an example of what the difference is in our society. Everyone's so critical of the U.S. They're in the Olympics and reporters are throwing out questions. What is it like representing a country after Minneapolis and the problems of having illegal immigration? And do you have a president like this? Whatever you think of the president, some don't like him. And they're answering, honestly, you're a snowboarder, you're a skier, you're a hockey player. Some love him, some don't. And then you have people like in Iran, where you don't sing the national anthem and you're going to get killed. Yeah, people have a problem with our country, and they say our freedoms are being taken away. Get a perspective.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
So Kathy Lee Gifford, one of our all-time favorite guests, is in studio. Brand new book out, Nero and Paul, How the Gospel of Grace Defeated the Ruler of Rome. It's out. Was it out? Is it out today?
Today
is the first day, but it's already doing really well.
It's on like four or five number ones.
Right.
Categories. It's a big bestseller already on Amazon. I want to thank everybody for that. I think there's a hunger, Brian, not only for hope. Everybody could use a little hope. Many people could use a lot, right? And we're all human that way. But there's also a desire for understanding in the world, because it's so bitter now. There's the root of bitterness has taken hold all over the world. And when you're bitter, you can't see straight. I want to learn something. I'll learn something from everybody I meet, even if I don't agree with them at all. Mm-hmm. I'd like to learn something about them by learning what they think. And that used to be the way human beings treated one another. One of the main reasons I left the New York area was not because there aren't nice people here. There are wonderful people here. But the culture had changed so much.
Because you seem to be having a great time on the Today Show.
Well, when I go back to the Today Show, it's because a lot of my friends are still there. And so I only go back when they ask me. I don't ever call up and say, I need a job. I don't anything like that. It's usually because somebody said, Kath, can you help us with this? Or can you help us with that? Or trying to sell a book like I am today. So I make the rounds. It's harder and harder to do it as the older you get. You don't like to get on planes anymore, I'm sure.
Oh, I love getting on planes.
You're as
What do you mean?
Who doesn't, right?
No, but I know now I don't because of the DHS, the lockout, what they're doing right now. But
that's unconscionable, by the way. And it should be a constitutional amendment that if anybody that closes down the government also doesn't get paid. Only fair.
Wouldn't it be great? And how about this, Kathy Lee? Now, you weren't always this big a success. You know what it's like to go from paycheck to paycheck, right?
Yes, of course
I did.
Can
you imagine making between $35,000 and $50,000 and then finding out you're not getting paid? That's what these TSA guys are finding out.
Yeah, nobody in this area can live on that.
No way.
New York. I'm not sure if there's any place in America left that you can. Royal, you know, I suppose. But, you know, I just feel so bad for people who they just deserve better from their government.
Right.
I don't have a D or an R near my name.
So I want to get and let everyone to know the stories about, and then we'll talk about other stuff. But first, let's talk about the book. Talk about the pairing, Nero and Paul. Why?
Mm-hmm. Because my son talked me into doing a series called Living Ancient Evil. Juxtaposed against living hope.
Right.
Because I'm asked the question all the time, do you think there's more evil in the world? It sure seems that way, you know? And it does. If you're looking at your phone and you're looking at the cable news, and we're all in cable news a lot, you know, you're going to think, wow, the world's worse than it's ever been. But when you really truly study history, it's not. It's not. I mean, there were very vile, bestial kingdoms all through history. And there's no shortage of epic antagonists in the Bible.
So Nero's running, you know, he's running Rome, right? What kind of leader was he?
Well, not a great one. None of the early ones that were real leaders, Julius Caesar, you know. And they just got worse and worse and worse, as far as I can read, as it came up. Power just corrupts completely. And, Julius Caesar's life didn't end well, and none of them did, none of them. Herod, our first book in this series, Herod and Mary, he called himself the king of the Jews. He wasn't even a Jew. And his death was beginning to happen right around the time Mary had just given birth to Jesus. Mm-hmm. So we juxtaposed the guy who said, I'm the king of the Jews, to the woman who was carrying the king of kings. And look at how the life and birth of and death and resurrection of Jesus changed everything for the whole world.
So these were Paul and Nero were contemporaries, right?
Paul and Nero were, but Nero was born quite a bit afterwards.
Right.
But they were alive at the same time, and it was Nero that was there when Paul was martyred.
So tell me how you characterize Paul.
Paul started out a zealot. Himself. First of all, let me tell you a tad more about Nero, because his mother, Agrippina, married like three times just to get the power enough so that her son would be able to become Caesar, and he did. Then he murdered her. Our book starts out that way, after sleeping with her for years.
Sleeping with his mother.
Of course, everybody did. Didn't they? I think so. Unbelievable. These books are so full of, we write them as thrillers. And Nero obviously had tons more action in that kind of a way than Paul. Paul was a very righteous rabbi, and Saul was. He was Saul at the time. And he was the biggest perpetrator of evil upon the believers in Jesus at the time, who were called the followers of the way. He was bound and determined. He wanted power, too, in his kingdom. But his kingdom was the kingdom of the Jews. Caiaphas, you've heard of him, the high priest, and the Sanhedrin, which like their council, and with the learned biblical, the scholars. He was a magnificent scholar, and on the road to Damascus, on his way to kill all these followers of the way, he heard a voice on that road, and it was Jesus, and he knew it. He said, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? And Saul said, who is this? Who is this? He said, it is me, Jesus. Why are you persecuting me? And he was blinded for 3 days. And so we tell, that's a well-known story, but we tell the story of how, what happened to him in terms of understanding that he was every bit as guilty as of the lust for power in his own world, you know? He was a brilliant scholar, as I said, but he was a dogmatic religious man. And I, you know how I feel about religion, that I don't like things that put people in chains. You know, I'm all about, you know, worshiping the living God.
No, so tell me, you think religion puts people in chains?
I do.
I know we asked you on television, but could you just tell it to our radio audience?
Not all people. I mean, I don't think religion, I just don't like to call it that because of what the way it's become known in the vernacular now. You know, people like to put us on a shelf. You know, I just did another thing. They said, well, all of her Christian books. And I said, no. I've written many, many, many books. But the people don't understand that the Bible from beginning to end is a Jewish story. We're the biblical ignorance is unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody in the Old Testament, pretty much, it's a story of how God created a nation, and it was the nation of the Jews. And people don't even know that Abraham and Sarah weren't Jews. No, they started out in modern-day Iraq, the land of Ur, and God called them to go leave their people and go to this land that God would show them and start a new nation. And the interesting thing part about it is this is the kind of stuff I learned that fascinates me. Their original names were Abram and Sarai. But when they got to the promised land and obeyed the Lord put an H in their name, an H, in obviously the Hebrew vocabulary, H in Abraham and H in Sarah. And what that represented was the breath of God being breathed into them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happens to all of us, too, when we obey the Lord.
So you don't like the rules that are associated with the Catholic religion, you know, stand up, sit down, appear here, go to hell if you don't do this.
You know, when Jesus came, he said, I have not come to condemn the law, but to fulfill it. And people for years have separated the Bible as the Old Testament was for the Jews and the New Testament is for the Christians, could not be more untrue. You know, there's 400 years between the last book in the Old Testament. I like to call it, if you're going to break down the Bible, which we never should have in the middle, there was 400 years between the time of the Jews being the Hebrews, and they weren't called Jews. The Hebrews were held in slavery under Pharaoh. We didn't stop the Bible because it was 400 years, but for some reason they stopped it between the last book of the Old Testament and Matthew and the New. And it's one story. It's one magnificent story. It's a love story.
What happened in those 400 years?
You know what? They didn't write it. Well, their books and things were written about them, but when they did the canon, I need to study that, honestly. I'm fascinated about what went into
it. It was the first time I heard that.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, I like to teach, but it's not because I'm a great teacher. It's because I have great teachers.
Mm-hmm.
I learn. I'm a student. And I want to learn what the Bible, not the Bible, I don't even really call it that anymore, because there's so many horrendous translations. I want to learn what the scriptures actually say in the original Hebrew, in the original Greek, or else I'm not getting the word of God.
Mm-hmm.
And
you don't want a translator. So in other words, you'll read yourself mm-hmm. and you'll discuss it, but you don't necessarily want a religion telling Kathy Lee Gifford what to think and what to conclude from these stories. Am I right?
I don't want King James, who was an evil, evil man, and the people that he got to translate the Bible. I don't want them telling me what the word of God says. Uh-uh. Because that man murdered countless people. And the men and they were all men then, who actually translated the Bible, they'd never been to Israel. They didn't know that Israel is, they talked about, you know, that Jesus was a carpenter. And everybody thinks in the worldwide that Jesus was a carpenter. First time I went to study rabbinically, I found out that that is not true. There was no buildable wood in first century AD.
He wasn't a carpenter?
He's a stonemason.
Oh,
there was no buildable wood. None. Everything that's in ruins now in the Holy Land, all over the Middle East, nothing is what wood doesn't preserve. It's destroyed.
How do they make furniture?
Well, they didn't even have tables. They laid down on mats and ate. There was no table at the Last Supper. Jesus worked with small. Here's a beautiful story. They had back then in first century AD, and if you read scripture, it's true that all of the buildable wood that they needed for construction had to be floated down the Via Maris, which means the road of the sea along the Mediterranean from Lebanon, north. And the Bible's scripture is clear about how they needed whatever they needed was brought over that way in rafts. taken to modern-day Joppa, which is just south of Tel Aviv, taken apart mm-hmm. and taken over land by animals and contraptions and slaves. You know, slaves. Everything that Herod built, and there's tons of stuff still standing, not fully, but, I mean, all rock. All rock. Mm-hmm. So then when you find out what the word tecton means in the New Testament, about what did Jesus do before he was a rabbi to make a living? What did his earthly father Joseph do, the two of them? And the word in the Greek is tekton, T-E-K-T-O-N. Mm-hmm. Well, if you look up, you go, Siri, what does tekton mean in Greek? It'll say architect / builder. Gotcha. So the geniuses from England go, oh, he was a carpenter that, like us.
And that's how it happened?
That's how it happened. And the Bible's... Yeah. The Bible bad translations are full of all those kinds of things.
Did you go back to the Today Show to talk about this?
Yeah, I did. Okay. And I made all kinds of videos about it. And people, a lot of people say, would you quit talking about this crap? You know, and it's, but it's not crap to me by any means. It's the most important way I can spend my life.
So Nero and Paul is the name of the book. It's out today. And go grab it. Keep it number one in all these categories.
Thank you, honey.
So, Kathy Lee, you did stop by there already. I'm just wondering what your thoughts were about what Savannah Guthrie is going through. I heard she's back in New York City.
I haven't heard that. I was just with very close friends of hers yesterday, and nobody mentioned that to me.
Okay.
All I can tell you is we were asked, all of those of us who are colleagues of hers and friends, and that's she didn't have any enemies over there at the Today Show. I didn't work with her on her hour, so I didn't know her as well as other people did. Not like Hoda, you know, and I spent 11 mm-hmm. years with Hoda. So anyway, but the minute I found out that this horrendous thing had happened, I started texting her, of course, texting and never getting a response, and I didn't need one. You know, I was lifting her up. You know, I'm not one of her closest friends, but I had been asked to do some media, and I was about to. I was coming on Fox and Friends. I was going to come on, and I had to call everybody and say, I just can't. A member of the family has requested that none of us do any media until mm-hmm. until it's resolved. Right now, the family can't deal with anything else. And I said, well, you know what? That's who I'm going to listen to. I don't mm-hmm. need to be on television anymore. But she did just this week. I got my first response from her. And I was stunned by it because I certainly didn't expect it and didn't need it. I know what I'm supposed to do. I'm supposed to lift her up to the living God and her whole family. And these were the three words she said, love you, friend. And right. I started to cry.
But she's also very spiritual. Very
she's, she's,
she came
she's,
by and did her book promotion at Fox.
Yes, that's right. She's a great, great lady. And she's written several you know, bestsellers about her faith. She teaches Sunday school, you know. But faith looks different to everybody. It really right. does. But if for me personally, I am I'm a history junkie like you are. Mm-hmm. But I'm fascinated since I was first in the Holy Land as a teenager about the epic stories in the Bible. But the trouble with the Bible, no matter what translation you're reading, is it's actually so huge and so voluminous. Is that the word? That it's as if you see it in black and white. You're ready. I mean, Nero's mentioned a couple of times. Herod's mentioned three times only in the story of Jesus' birth, right? So anyway, that's not enough for me. I want the details. Right. And the only way you get the details is studying the Greek and the Hebrew. And you find all of a sudden this faith of yours, at least mine, that had become incredibly lukewarm years ago.
Right. Nero and Paul, go pick up this book. Find out two stories that you need to know more about and continue to pick up all Kathy Lee's series. Kathy Lee, great to see you again.
Just got
to
say, it becomes some Technicolor and Dolby sound when you study that way.
Oh, yeah. And also you did the book on tape. Oh,
the audio is a thriller, baby.
Talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Timothée Chalamet is being criticized by major opera and ballet organizations after he said that no one cares about those art forms. Chalamet made the comment on a press tour for his movie about ping pong.
All right, so what did he say? I don't even know. He said no one cares. It's kind of true. I mean, do you know people, average person goes, I saw the ballet. Not that it doesn't take great athletes. But do you know anyone that says, I went to the ballet? Do you know anyone? Seriously.
No, the only people...
If your kid's not in the show?
That's fair. The only people I really hear that ever go to it are like the super crazy affluent that have so much money to be like, oh, I went to go see da-da-da to sound great and probably in their super lefty bubble. But otherwise, I don't hear of anyone going to that.
Right. By the way, why is Timothée Chalamet not winning anything?
I mean, I've heard mixed reviews, right? Didn't you think the movie would... Oh, you loved the movie. Someone else was saying it was just
okay. I mean, I had a better ending. I would have done a better ending, but he was phenomenal.
Yeah. But for the Academy Award, it gets so political. And like,
what did he do wrong? A Nick fan?
Well, maybe. But also people think, you know, has he put in enough time? Has he done enough? Which, I mean, he has. He's done an incredible amount. I'm not saying he hasn't.
Right.
But I'm saying it just gets political.
All right. Let's find out if there's even more to know. How about this? The Obama Foundation, 10 years after he left office, they are finally ready to open up his presidential center. It'll open in Chicago's South Side on June 18th as a, quote, global hub for hope and change. And the celebrations will last for 3 days into June 21st. Valerie Jarrett, his longtime aide, said the foundation CEO and former White House senior advisor, said on MSNBC that President Trump won't be invited to the grand opening. After we opened to the public, she said, should President Trump want to come and tour the center, President Obama would be delighted for him to do so. Hope is getting a permanent home, former President Obama said in an announcement video. There'll be a new branch of Chicago Public Library and, yes, a basketball court.
Notes that I think going to be so interesting. Fast forward a few years when Trump starts to build his library. How many stories do you think are going to be out there about whatever issues they might perceive about that library being built? And we hear barely anything about Obama's library.
It's unbelievable. They're going to find out about the fundraising problems, the course overruns, the shoddy way it was built. First off, just by looking at it, I'm not an architect, but it's the ugliest thing I've ever seen. It looks like a big mistake, right?
Yeah, but I mean, everyone, it's Obama, so everyone's going to love it.
So Trump has a debate going on. He's got enough money. They got the site picked out in Miami. Should he start before he leaves office?
That's a good question. I mean, I say yes, why not?
Right. And by the way, so does his family say yes. But he said, wow, that would be so, you know, so different, even for him, he said. So it's interesting. It's good to know it's paid for.